Hi there and welcome to Sound Vibe. In this podcast, I speak with Saskia Tompkins, who is a violinist and a nickel harper. She's from the UK and now lives in Canada. So sit back and enjoy the show. Hello, Saskia. It's great to see you.
Hi, how you doing?
It's so great to see you. And what time is it out there now, roughly?
It's 4:40 p.m. So it's minus 22 outside and the sun's just going down and it's snowing.
Oh, sounds so idyllic. We're going to get straight into your first track now called Volga Bolga. So firstly, can you tell me where you are actually from?
I'm from Kent, Canterbury, Kent in England. I was actually born in London, but we moved when I was a toddler down to the southeast. So that's the nearest bit of England to France.
Right. Yeah. And was that where your music started then? And how did you get into it?
So, yeah, when I was seven, my parents, who are lovely music fans and artists, said to me, do you want to learn an instrument? And I said, yes. And they said, what do you want to learn? And I said, I want to learn the harp. And they went, well, harps are expensive, but there's a violin teacher in the village. And I went, okay. So I'm a violinist. It was that simple.
I didn't know about the harp part. That's really interesting. And actually, you play a nickel harp now, is that right?
Oh, I play the nickel harper, yeah. But that's not quite a harp. But it's smaller.
Not quite the same kind of one. But I'm going to ask you a little bit about that later anyway. And what types of music do you like to play?
I like to play good music, so I don't really care what genre it is. I'm one of these people, I'm one of these musicians who's like a kid in the sweet shop. You know, you go, oh, I want some of that and some of that and some of that. So I, at the moment, most of my living is playing folk music from various parts of the world, and sometimes some jazz and also orchestral music. So I play in a couple of orchestras with violin. So that's where I'm at the moment.
What made you emigrate all the way from Kent out to Canada?
Well, I met this guy.
Who was that? Stephen
Hannigan, who's he's from Northern Ireland. But he'd been living in England since he was 16, and he's a musician as well, and he kept touring over here in Canada, and he kept saying to me, we should move to Canada, you'd really like it out here. And I kept saying, I'm not moving to Canada, it's cold and it gets too much snow. And then he brought me for a visit on one of his tours, and I was like, oh, this is kind of nice. And then we'd moved to Northampton. We both lived in London, and then we moved to Northampton, Milton Keynes in Northampton. And our kids were growing up, because we've got three kids, and this is like fast forward through history. And our youngest, our oldest son was about 7 or 8 at the time. And Northampton was not a good place at the time for children. They were like gangs of kids, graffitiing and sticking glue in people's locks and smoking things off 10, 11-year-olds. And I was like, I don't want that for my kids.
No.
So I said, let's try Canada because it can't be any worse. And we came here, and I am so grateful I moved here because this is just such a great place to be on so many levels.
Well, everybody, all the expats in China want to move to Canada. It's really the in thing at the moment.
Well, they're opening the gates to more immigrants because they don't have enough people. They don't have enough young people coming up to support the aging population. So, yeah, it's actually quite easy to to move here right now.
Yeah. So what types of work have you been doing recently? One of the ones which looked actually quite interesting was, I think, your mixed museum project. Was that just last year?
Yeah, that was amazing. So I got contact. Yeah, the mixed museum, I don't know if you've looked at it. It's an online museum for mixed race people out of England, out of Britain. It's run from London, from Brentford.
Right.
And it has the full support and financial backing of Cambridge University.
Right.
And so I got contacted by Folk Alliance International, which is International Folk Music Association based in the States in Kansas City, to be their artist in residence to do a short video about my history, my family history. And they said, we'd like to team up with another organization, and they were going to team me up with the US Army, because my grandfather was African-American GI that went to Britain in the Second World War. But then I told them about the mixed museum, and they said, hey, that sounds way more interesting. And they teamed us up, and now I'm the artist in residence with the mixed museum currently, but they're just looking for more funding. It's fantastic.
And what's that been like? Because I've seen you posting a little bit about it, and it looks really amazing and quite fascinating. What's the process been like?
Wow. Okay. So during the pandemic, we had a gig. I'm going back to the beginning. I was asked to do a gig in somebody's garden, and it was a songwriter's circle. And even though I'm not a songwriter, I was asked to go because I could play with the others and also do my own stuff. And I had this really pressing need to play something more blues, which I don't normally do in public, in recent years anyway. And I thought, well, I can't just sit here and improvise. So I've had this thing going on because I've been recently learning about my family. And I told the story of my grandfather and my mum and my grandmother very briefly on stage, and then played this piece of music that kind of came out of me. And then the director of Folk Alliance International, man called Angus Finnan, happened to be there and came up and asked me. So because he wanted me to do this thing, I had to do a deep dive and talk to my mum, who's still in England, about a deep dive into her family history and her childhood, which was really traumatic, full of basically in after the Second World War, the babies of Black American GIs and white English women were cleaned up, were tidied up and put into children's homes by the government. I mean, that happens all over the world, right? It happened in Canada as well with Indigenous children. We call it the 60s scoop, which at the moment is currently being talked about a lot. And it happened to my mum for slightly different reasons. But so there was a lot of digging up a lot of pain, and kudos to my mum. She did it, bless her, and she was with me all the way. It's really cathartic, but yes, also realizing coming to terms with the fact that I'm part white and part black.
Yes,
the journey. It's a big journey, and yes, being accepted by the black community as one of them.
Yes,
even though, yeah, it's been a really interesting journey.
Yes.
And for my kids as well, it's been great for them. Actually, they're more black than I am, which is kind of strange in terms of attitude and,
yeah,
you know, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been great. And I'm now trying to explore that in my music. which right. this project helped me to do.
Yeah, it sounds so powerful. Yeah. And with your other work, what else? You said just today that you've been playing with an orchestra, so you're obviously doing quite a mix of work. What other projects are happening out there for you?
I have this amazing string quartet that we formed during the pandemic called Medusa. And a friend of mine called me up and said, hey, I want to jam with people because I'm desperate for music. And a group of us met in a park in Toronto and on a bandstand just to play together, just because we needed to play with other people. And there happened to be a film crew there making a documentary about 100 years of that park. And they went, wow, what's your band called and who are you? And we were like, whoa, this is weird. So we allow the music for that documentary. It was kind of one of these weird things. But when we were playing, I was like, this is magic. Yes. Gosh, this is something else. There was, with music, when you play with some people, you go, oh, this is cool. And then with other people, it's like there's something almost visceral that's around the edges that you can't quite touch that makes it extra special, takes you the extra place. And that was happening. So, and since then, we've gone, okay, well, we found a name, Medusa, because in the band, I'm the mixed race person.
Right.
So we've got two queer members. One is non-binary, and the fourth member, Marta, she's a recent immigrant from Poland. So there's a lot of stuff that we've all dealt with, and Medusa was a misunderstood person. Comes from trauma, but also an amazing mythological story.
Creating the film, you're in the park. Yeah. Well, not creating the film, yeah. But the film crew turned up. Yeah.
And we also play, like I have my nickel harpa, which was an instrument that almost got lost in the midst of time. Marta, the Polish woman, plays knee fiddles, which are instruments that were discovered in the 80s from Poland, traditional instruments. So she single-handedly has revived them. Plus the traditional string quartet formation. And we're playing our own arrangements of traditional folk music, plus some that we've written in the style of, from all over the world. Well, we've got as far as North Africa so far, so Europe and North Africa. And we're expanding further. And it's just quite magic, and it seems to be taking off, and everybody loves it. And, yeah, it's really exciting.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the story of Medusa? Because people might not know it.
So Medusa, the main story of Medusa was from Greek mythology, though different cultures all over the world have versions of her. She was sexually abused by Neptune, the god, and as a beautiful young woman. And Athena, the goddess of love, was so incensed by this that she punished Medusa. And she said, you are going to be unattractive to men. And she turned her hair into snakes. And every time she looks at a human or a man, she turns them to stone. So there's kind of a self-preservation thing going on in there as well. And her two sisters protected her. But in many cultures, she didn't just have snakes for hair. She has tusks. She has facial hair. She doesn't have feet. She'll have a fish tail, which is kind of mermaid type thing. Yeah. But it's very interesting in today's political society where the Me Too movement and all this stuff and yet this ancient, it's a really interesting fit.
How did you feel about the Me Too movement? Was that quite big in Canada? Because it was quite a surprise here. I'm in China now, so the way I received it here, it was quite, oh, what's this? Oh my goodness. How did you feel about it?
I thought it was about time. it was big in Canada, the whole of North America, actually. There was the marches trying to get equal rights in all sorts of different levels of society. Of course, the US seems to have gone backwards with banning abortion. But it was big here, and it really helped not just women, but not non-binary and men came out as well with stories of abuse and stuff, which they talked about it on the CBC, which is the national radio, Canadian radio. And yeah, it was very good. It's been very positive here. Very positive.
That's great to hear. Excuse me, I'm getting very husky. Which teachers influence you the most as a musician and why?
Wow. Okay. So this is interesting. I'm going to go backwards.
Okay.
When I met you, we were at university together.
Yes.
Which was a million years ago, it feels like. And we did a jazz degree, but I wanted a classical violin lessons. So they found a teacher for me called Michael from the Brodsky String Quartet. And he was fantastic because he saw that I had this freedom as a musician, and he managed to harness that and give me some discipline within the music, but with a lot of kindness, because I'd had a few teachers who were less than kind before then, and he was very good. And he's now in Italy, by the way, playing Baroque music and wearing those crazy wigs and things. It's kind of weird. I found a video of him on YouTube. Anyway, and then the other teacher, of course, was Stuart Hall there, who took me under his wing. He was the guitar teacher on the course, but he persuaded me or asked me to go and join all his guitar lessons so that he could have somebody to play the melodies, but also I could learn the jazz stuff. And he taught me, he used to push CDs at me and cassettes at me all the time with crazy music from all over the world. And he introduced me to Bulgarian music and Balkan music and odd timing. So, 11 eighths, 13 eighths and things. And I remember the time when I just couldn't hear it and I couldn't play it. And he would just repeat until I got the hang of it. And now I can't get that stuff out of my head.
There's a couple brilliant
odd timings. So he was super, super influential. Yeah, those are the two main ones. When I was 11, a new teacher came to my school who I heard him playing fiddle. He was a school teacher, but in our break time, I heard him playing Irish fiddle, and I knocked on the classroom door and said, "What are you playing? I want to learn that." So he taught me how to play Irish fiddle, and he taught me by ear, whereas previously I'd just been playing by music, you know, sheet music. And he taught me by ear and taught me how to listen and taught me how to breathe the music and allow it to breathe. Because with a bow, you can just, if you're singing, you have to breathe. If you're playing a wind instrument, you have to breathe. But the bow can just keep going. And I still remember that lesson and saying, we don't have to breathe, but we have to, because the audience need you to. Otherwise, you lose them.
Yes, that's so true. And so playing by ear, did this take long or did this naturally happen for you? Because did you, when you were younger, you did some of the violin school. Was that right? Or if I got that?
I didn't do Suzuki. Suzuki teaches by ear, but I never did Suzuki.
Right.
My earliest teachers were like, oh, you can read music easily. Let's play Bach, you know, boom, and there it was. But I remember it took a while for me to know how to listen. And now I don't understand why people can't just do it. Yeah.
And can we talk a little bit about with Stefan Hannigan as well? And obviously with him being a musician and more, did that change your playing and your music in any way? And in what way?
That's really interesting. Stefan is, as I said earlier, is from Northern Ireland, and he's a fantastic Irish musician of Irish music, amongst many other things. I started having Irish fiddle lessons from this teacher at school, and then I went on to play in bands and pubs and things. When I met Stefan, he asked me to sub for the fiddle player in his band, who were called Shanae, because the fiddle player I would be covering was doing Riverdance at the time. And I was like, sure, we've got a tour, it's exciting. And what I discovered with this band of very traditional Irish players is that I actually didn't know how to play Irish music. I could play the tunes, but I didn't hear what they were hearing. And one of the members, and Stefan, said, "You're not listening." And I didn't know what I was supposed to be listening for. So I had to go and study the music just by listening and listening and listening until I suddenly heard. It's like I think of it like one of those magic eye drawings. You know, when you look at them and it just looks like patterns, and if you look hard enough, suddenly a picture appears and then you can't unsee it. And that's what it was like, because I didn't know what I was supposed to listen for. So Stefan really, really influenced me by kind of letting me into the secret, you know, into the secret, really.
Yes.
So I'm very well known as an Irish fiddle player. I'm very good.
Right.
But it's been a lot of work. But yes. I'm very good now, and it comes naturally. And the same, a real one. The same happens with this is the thing. Partly why I mean, I play so many different types of music. But I discovered through that it's the same with other types of music, other traditions. It's really easy to say, oh, I play this kind of music. But if you haven't immersed yourself in it, then you do a almost like a pale photocopy of it. Thank you.
Tuish come about? I love the name, actually. And I was kind of thought it was cool because we were going to be meeting at Tuish. And then you, lady, changed the appointment time. And I thought, oh, that was a nice little thing. It would have been Tuish in Canada.
That's really fantastic. And I'm so sorry. Oh, dear. I don't know how the name came about. I don't remember. So when we moved to Canada, Stefan said, there's a guitarist you have to meet.
Right.
Like, yeah, right, whatever. So this guy turned up and they were jamming and I made a cup of tea and I went downstairs into the basement where they were playing and I was like, whoa, he's really good. So I got my fiddle out. And then I started playing and then Stefan kind of disappeared into the background.
Yeah.
And I totally fell in love musically with Brandon right. Bishara.
Yeah.
And when we get together, it's that magic that I was talking about with Medusa. It's like this thing happens.
Yeah.
And we've written the music for and released two albums, but it's all acoustic and instrumental. There's no singing.
Right.
And he's one of these guitarists that ties his fingers in knots doing what he hears in his head. And it's really magic. It's interesting because when we go on tour together, everyone thinks we're married or we're in a couple. And we're not at all, but on stage, we're so intimate that people find it hard to believe how you can be intimate with your music and not off stage.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really magical.
Yeah. Yeah.
I kind of miss it. The pandemic's kind of thrown it sideways, but we're trying to get back together again. So,
what's it been like through the pandemic? How has that been in Canada? As a musician and just genuinely for you, how has it impacted you?
I'm lucky because I live in a house with Stefan, who's my husband, obviously, who plays music. And we also have another couple of people that rent our basement. And Andrew is also a musician. Andrew Randall, he plays cello and now nickel harper because of me. So I got to play even when it was locked down and you weren't allowed to go anywhere except for grocery shopping. Do you remember those days?
Yeah.
They were awful. I live in the country, so I've got trees and flowers and my butterfly garden. So I'd float around in a dream pretending the outside world didn't exist and had people to play music with.
Ah, that helps.
So I'm really blessed. But what I found, I also made sure that I had an hour. I practiced for at least an hour a day. I'm tend to be fairly undisciplined, but I made myself every day at 11 p.m. I practiced for an hour, so that I kept up. But what I found is that I missed audiences so much. And I always knew, well, you probably find this as well, you know that a concert or a gig is a two-way thing, is a sharing of energy, and it's a gift, you know, but I hadn't realized quite how important it was. And I always play way better when they've got people watching me or listening than in my bedroom.
Yes, I understand that. Yeah. Yeah.
Because some people are, sometimes some of us are performers. That's where we're most comfortable, is on the stage, strangely. So, yeah, my heart grieved for that. And it's really nice to be back.
So can you tell me a bit more about your family? You've spoken about Stefan, but you've got three children. Are they musical too? And what's it been like being a musician and a mum and, you know, and as well, and all these family aspects?
I have three amazing children. They're now all adults. I used to tour when I gigged and toured when they were tiny, when they were babes in arms, when I was breastfeeding. I'd just take them with me, most of the time, which was kind of crazy. And I don't recommend it in some ways, but I absolutely recommend it in others. So when they were tiny, tiny, I would have them in a car seat in front of me on stage because I don't play loud music. So yes, it was okay. And then when they started to want to move around, I used to take the travel cot, playpen thing up the side of the stage with books and toys and the kids in there. Aww. And then when they started climbing out, well, it's just free for all. And it was wonderful. And I made a very conscious decision to take them with me so that I could be a mother.
Yes.
Rather than leaving them with somebody all the time.
Yeah.
So that they didn't see me. And so because of that, you couldn't keep them off stage. So absolutely, they're all musicians. So my son is now 24. He'll be 25 this year. That's crazy. Oshin Hannigan. And he's a phenomenal percussionist. And he lives in Montreal. And he now has a really lovely studio, recording studio called Banjaxed, which he co-owns with somebody. And they're really successful. And he's touring all over the world with all sorts of people, mostly hand percussion, but also drum kit. He's a really great, really into his folk music from all around the world. He's a fantastic Arabic percussionist and jazz drummer, as well as the Irish stuff.
Yeah.
And then Ella, she's now a mum. She's 22 and she's got a 9-month-old baby. So she's taking a little bit of time, but she's singing and playing guitar.
Yeah.
And then Aisha, youngest, who's now, she's nearly 20. That's crazy. And she's singing and writing her own songs with somebody else. And but we gigged with them. We went out as a family band called Clan Hannigan, and the girls sang and did Irish dancing and beautiful harmonies. And yeah, Oshin was a percussionist. And
an amazing family.
It's families that gig together stay together. That's the motto. Yeah.
Yes. And it wasn't a Spinal Tap kind of family or anything. We see these lovely pictures of you all together. It's fascinating. And
we were really good.
Yeah.
We were really good at doing Spinal Tap in the car. And as soon as the car doors opened, we were on form.
Oh, really? Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. It's never all sunshine and rainbows and lollipops, you know.
Oh, that is funny. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But we never pushed them into it. They always did it free will. We always said, if you don't want to do a gig, that's fine, but you've got to let us know ahead of time.
Fair enough. Very fair enough. So can you tell me a little bit about your violin teaching now and what type of students you have? And what's your philosophy in teaching? Because you've spoken about some experiences that have been inspiring for you to receive as a student, but also ones which maybe have been a bit more challenging. So perhaps how that impacts in your work.
So I could talk about neurodiversity, couldn't I? That would be a thing. I've recently discovered that I've got ADHD, funnily enough, and also I've got a family full of people with autism. Like my son and my daughter are both autistic, and what that does when you come from an outside the box perspective when you're teaching, especially kids but also adults, what I'm very good at doing is reading people. I don't teach a method. I'm very against teaching methods for myself because I don't have the attention span partly, but also it doesn't always fit people. So I'm very good at feeling out what a student needs and following that path, following their path rather than making them fit my box. So I've been teaching for years privately, but recently I got rid of most of my students and I started teaching on an El Sistema program. Don't know if you know El Sistema.
No.
It's There's this amazing program that came out of Venezuela. A man, a musician, saw kids on the streets and on the rubbish dumps and things and thought, this is horrendous. And so he decided to teach them music and then taught them how to build their own instruments. And now the youth orchestra, the El Sistema Venezuelan Youth Orchestra, is world renowned. But the movement spread across the world. So it's teaching children music, to play music, regardless of their economic status, so where they come from. So I now teach in Peterborough. It's not funny, Peterborough in Canada, Peterborough, 3 days a week. I teach, I have 12 beginner violin, viola students from the ages of 8 to 12, and there's 20 violin students that are taught by other people. So 3 days a week, they get a hot meal. They get their violin or viola lessons in small groups. They get music theory and they get a choir.
That's amazing.
And
yeah,
it's fantastic, and it's all paid for by the organization. So government funded. Grants.
Sounds very special.
It's really special, and there's a lot of refugee children there, plus others, and there's a lot of neurodiversity amongst the children as well, autism and ADHD and anxieties and things. So I'm working with that aspect as well, and it's magical. It's absolutely magical to see these kids respond to the music and get excited about it and want to play and want to take their instruments home and practice. It's fantastic, and it's so rewarding.
Yes. There sounds like there's quite a lot of trauma and difficulty for them.
I think there is with most societies around the world.
They're refugees, but
refugees, definitely. And also, if you come from a sort of low income, family struggles, we call them latch kids, where you let yourself in to your home after school because your parents are at work, or there's a lot of stuff that people deal with. But this is a safe place for the kids to come, and it's kind of magic. And so they've got a community that's together, and they have a person there as well who works with the kids with their emotional and mental stuff.
Okay. One question I've got now is, because many people listen in who are keen musicians, some professional, some amateur, what advice would you give to perhaps violinists first and those wishing to improve their playing? Any tips?
Wow. Practice. Oh, that's a big question. That's kind of what would I tell my younger self, I suppose. What do I tell them? I would say it's very okay. The harder you try, the more difficult it gets. Sometimes you have to be more zen and let go physically as well. So violin is a very physical instrument in terms of positioning and things. And what I see is a lot, especially adults, I see them trying hard, and the harder they try, the tighter they get, the more tense, and then it all falls to pieces. So be zen and let it go.
Yes.
That's important.
Yeah.
Also practice. Yeah. There's a lot of Suzuki method teachers in Canada. It's the big method. And it works really well for some people, but not for everybody. So it depends how your brain works as to whether it suits you or not.
I did know of one little boy in the end. He was very excited to go along and he'd been fiddling with a violin. But then when he did Suzuki and he had to go through the rituals, sorry to call them rituals, I don't know what else other word to use, but he got bored and he was like, well, now he doesn't want to do it because it took so long. And actually he wanted to be really hands on. So is that the kind of thing that you're talking about perhaps, that, or is it other things?
Yeah, that's it, because it's very much very repetitive. Do as I do and right. Do as I, you know. There's, especially in the early years, there's very little room for creativity.
Yes.
And the creativity, if you persevere, from what I've observed, the creativity comes later. After you've got all the technique stuff and all the preciseness.
Yeah.
But some of us are a bit more chaotic than that, and it doesn't fit. So I've had children come to me who've been doing Suzuki and wanted to give up, and what they've needed is a very creative approach. Well, let's write music together, let's make up stuff, let's improvise, let's see if we can make sounds that sound like blue. I know this sounds really hippy dippy, but
not at all.
Yeah. So that they can find the love of the music.
Yes.
Because the thing about music is you can't touch it. It's you've got to find the excitement and the love in it, and then makes you want to play.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I've come to the end of my questions, Saskia, and it's been incredible to talk to you and to catch up. Is there anything else you'd like to share that perhaps I haven't asked you?
Oh, well, I mean, we didn't talk about the nickel harper.
Oh, yes, and naughty me.
Naughty you. And you should absolutely, all your listeners need to go and Google keyed fiddles or nickel harper, spelt with a Y, nickel, or Swedish keyed fiddle.
Okay.
And it's just the most extraordinary instrument, and there needs to be more players in the world. For sure. And I'm looking for students because I've never taught anybody.
So
I'm really good at it.
how did it happen? How did you come across it? And
there's a festival in, there used to be a festival in France, in Massif Central, right in the middle of France, called Saint-Chartier. And it was an instrument makers festival. And I got taken there when I was about 16. By a hurdy-gurdy playing friend of mine, Phil Martin, who incidentally used to earn his living by busking in the butter market in Canterbury. He'd wear a Dick Turpin hat and cape and take his hurdy-gurdy out, and that's how he earned his living. And he said, hey, do you want to go to a festival? And me, I was like, yeah, sure. So we drove across to central France in this old van, and I remember watching the sunflowers coming up in the morning, waking up, and we're driving through a field of sunflowers. It was amazing. Anyway, I digress. There was a nickel harper maker there at this festival in a castle grounds, about 3,000 people in this little castle grounds, and this nickel harper maker. And instead of jamming with other people and dancing and going and looking at everything, I sat for 3 days and played his nickel harps because I fell in love. And then I couldn't afford one. And then I was a student and I still couldn't afford one. And then I had kids and I still couldn't afford one. And then Stefan was gigging with a musician called Lorena McKinnett, a Canadian singer. And she said, I want a nickel harper on this piece of music, and gave him the money. And he went out and bought one and ended up not playing it on the gig. And then gave it to me. And
your dream came true.
I did. And it's my muse and my soulmate and the most amazing, beautiful instrument ever.
And playing the nickel harp, how is it tuned? Is it hard to do? And I wouldn't have a clue.
So it has 16 strings.
Right.
But you only play four of them. And I tune it like a viola. So it's tuned in fifths. So from the bottom to the top is C, G, D, and A.
Ah.
And then it has 12 sympathetic strings, which are tuned in semitones.
Yes.
Chromatically. And they run through the middle of the bridge, and because they're tuned, as long as they're in tune, they resonate every time you play the notes on the other strings.
Right.
And give it this kind of reverb like you're playing in the church.
Yes.
And then instead of putting your fingers on the strings, you press in keys, which press these little wooden tangents which touch the strings.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's played with a bow, short bow. And it's crazy. It's insane.
Is there much music written for it? Or are you playing by ear?
There are some books, Nicol Harper books, written of traditional Swedish tunes.
Yes.
And there's a big tradition of playing it. It nearly died out in the 60s, but the tunes are still there.
Yeah.
But I don't play much Swedish music on it. I use it for everything else.
Yeah.
I play Arabic music on it and Irish music and classical music and whatever I feel like music. But in England, for those British listeners, there's a woman called Vicky Swan who's single-handedly changed the Nicol Harper world there. She plays because I said, look what I've got at a festival. And we sat on a park bench and ate fish and chips. And she played my Nicol Harper and went, well, I'm Swedish and I never knew about this. So she studied it. And then now she's got camps all over the place and students. And
amazing.
It's fantastic how it's taken off.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you mind me asking, how much does one cost? Is it more than a harp?
No, it's more than a cheap harp, because I think cheap harps are about $2,000. Of course, I think in dollars now.
That's okay. I'm still on the, well, I'm in the Chinese yuan now, so...
Yeah, I mean, it explodes your brain, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you can buy Nicol Harper for $5,000 or $6,000, which is Canadian dollars, not US dollars. So it's about $4,500 US dollars. So that's what, £3,000 English?
Wow. Okay.
That's quite enough.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I mean, I could always sell my violin and buy two, but I don't want to.
No, because your violins have got stories, I think. Reading about them, they sound special too. Don't sell your violin.
You've been listening to Saskia Tompkins talking about her life as a musician. If you'd like to hear more about musicians and artists and composers from all over the globe, then you might like to subscribe on your pod app to Jane Nicola Sound Vibe. You can even subscribe on your pod app or visit my website at janenicolasoundvibe.com. Jane Nicola Sound Vibe.